I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. The music you've just heard, which we use for our open, is The Garden by Bobby McFerrin. And actually, it's quite apropos because the theme of this podcast, which has been going on now, it's in its ninth year, is connecting the dots between ourselves, our well-being, the well-being of our communities, and everything going on in our total environment, radiating out from our individual selves and regions and neighborhoods to our entire society and to the living global ecosystem of planet Earth, you know, which is a garden that we can either tend to or, you know, treat in a neglectful manner, or something in between, you know, maybe not even realize where we are and, you know, our profound connection to each other and our habitat. So I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, health and food, policy and media, and popular attitudes. And each week on this show, we talk about different facets of our interconnected world. And, you know, we talk with scientists, thought leaders, authors, filmmakers, poets, photographers, and farmers. And, of course, we've covered farming, food and farming quite a lot on this show over its 9 years. And so we're going to be taking a turn now in this and a couple of upcoming programs to our ongoing interwoven theme of regenerative agriculture and food farming. And our guest today is a return guest. He's been on the show repeatedly. This may be the third or fourth time. And so if you like this show, you can also find other programs with him in archives. But with us today once again, and warmly welcome, is Dave Chapman, who wears multiple hats. He is himself a farmer and a grower and the proprietor of Longwind Farm. He also manages the Real Organic Project, which we're going to be talking about today. And he's basically helping us, and has been really doing this for a while, track what is going, you know, both the significance and need for organic and regenerative agriculture, as well as really looking very closely at the public policies and initiatives that either support this, you know, what has been a thriving movement with tremendous demand for healthier food, you know, or undermine it. So we're going to get an update from him today of where we are now, and I'm delighted to have you back on Connect the Dots, Dave Chapman.
Thank you, Allison. I'm happy to be here.
So, you know, you were one of the founding group that founded the Real Organic Project. And, you know, out of concern that what is named or labeled as organic is, you know, may not really meet the standards of organic, and that is something that we need to not deny or sweep under the carpet, but pay attention to and do something about. Do you want to, if you would, just give our listeners a little introduction to, you know, who yourself and others who are the animating force and participants in the Real Organic Project, and, you know, what your, you know, how you define your vision and, you know, intentions for it?
Sure. So I am one of 45 board members. We have an advisory board, a standards board, and an executive board. And, you know, those 45 people came together, and they were not the only ones, but we picked them basically for their prominence. And, you know, I think the Real Organic Project really grew out of a meeting of about 30 farmers in Vermont after a rather catastrophic meeting of the National Organic Standards Board, which advises the USDA and represents you and me. And the members of that are not selected by you and me. They're selected by the Secretary of Agriculture. And, you know, I think that the selections have been getting wonkier and wonkier, and they're about to get really wonky as Sonny Perdue gets to choose 10 out of the 15 members over the next year. But in any case, we got together and we were pretty dismayed at what was happening with the National Organic Program. And, you know, the question at that very impromptu meeting was, are we going to just suck it up and live with it? Or are we going to do something about it? And the consensus was to do something about it. And we ultimately, after a lot of conversations, decided to create an add-on label that would reflect more of the original intention of the National Organic Program when it was formed. When the National Organic Program was formed, it actually, you know, Congress passed a good law. The OFPA, it's called the Organic Food Production Act, is well-written, it's well thought out, and it's a good, moderate, sane interpretation of the organic principles that created the organic movement. And I think that when it was created, there was a lot of doubt and concern in the organic farming community, and I'm sure in the eating community too, that the government might mess it up. But the law was good. And I think, you know, we have to accept that or acknowledge that the National Organic Program has done a lot of good things to help the organic movement grow nationally, so that, you know, you can walk into certainly on the coast, virtually any supermarket, and be able to buy certified organic food, which is a, you know, tremendous shift from 30 years ago, where there was almost no store you could walk in and buy organic food. But we see organic sales are booming. Their last count I saw, they were at $52 billion. And that is not because of a great advertising effort. That is because as people start to learn some of the dismal realities of the conventional food system, they're seeking an alternative. They want food that's healthier. They want food that is grown in a way that is less destructive or even beneficial for the land. They want to buy food that is not based on serfdom for the agricultural farm workers. So all of these things, and finally, they want to grow food that is not destructive to the climate. So all of these things are leading people, a lot of people, to turn to the USDA organic seal. And, you know, we should only celebrate that. That is an amazing thing, this social movement where people are seeking a better way to eat. Unfortunately, with that success comes that success equates to money, and that equates to blood in the water. So corporate sharks come in because there's money to be made. And so now we cannot take for granted that, isn't it wonderful that people are choosing organic. We need to actually work pretty hard to protect not just the brand, not just the label, but protect the meaning of the label. And that's what the Real Organic Project was formed to do. And that's why those 45 people who include many organic pioneers who were growing organic food long before the USDA got involved. When I started as an organic farmer, the USDA hated us. And I think there's still elements of the USDA that hates us. But, you know, there are other elements that have said, you know, we can work this out. And I don't mean that everybody in the USDA is a bad player, because there's some great people there, but well, that's a different conversation, isn't it? So, did I answer any of your questions?
No, that's really good. I just want to briefly note, you know, that in what you just said, you mentioned that over the next year, Sonny Perdue, who is the current USDA Secretary of Agriculture, you know, Secretary of the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, appointed by Donald Trump, that he will be actually naming, you know, 10 out of 15 members of the regulatory board, the National Organic Standard Board. And I just want to mention that if people didn't catch the reference to who he is. And also because this is an alarming development, you know, with the wrong people coming in, with pro-industry people coming in to cut corners, you know, it could further erode things from where we are now. And I think we'll talk, you know, we'll speak, you know, ask you to kind of help us orient to where we are now. But this, I just want to preface it by pointing out that this could get much worse over the next year. And so this is really a time to be organizing and gathering to defend healthy, organic food and regenerative
absolutely.
Grown.
This is mm-hmm. the equivalent of Donald Trump appointing 2/3 of the judges on the Supreme Court in the next year. I mean, that's that's what we're talking about, is that out of 15 people who are chosen from farmers, from consumers, from nonprofits, from stores, to represent the American organic community to the National Organic Program, to the USDA, and 2/3 of them are going to be picked by Sonny Perdue, who is not our friend. And he has said things that are contemptuous, just sort of needlessly hateful. I don't, you know, I don't see any strategy to it. It just seems random. But he does not have an understanding of what organic means, nor does he seem to want to learn. So it's not the person, I think, who should be in charge of picking people to represent you and me. But this is what's happened. You know, this is where we're at politically. But I want to add one other thing, Allison, that is important, which is that this 15-member board is an advisory board, and they make recommendations to the National Organic Program, who then goes through a rulemaking process, and ultimately the rules that the changes that they decide on are accepted or rejected by the USDA. So it's a long, convoluted process, and these 15 people are only advisors. And of the last 20 recommendations that they have made for rules that should change, and that represents the last 9 years of recommendations, not a single one has made it to rulemaking. And so that's a staggering thing, too. And that happened under Obama. So we can't just blame everything on Donald Trump. You know, even with Vilsack as Secretary of Agriculture, they were not acting on the recommendations of the National Organic Standards Board. And this came up in a House subcommittee hearing, and Greg Ibach, who's the Undersecretary of Agriculture and is ultimately the one who is responsible for the National Organic Program, was asked by a Republican congressman, why haven't you acted on the last 20 recommendations? And Ibach basically dodged the question twice. And the third time it was asked, he said, well, you know, we're choosing 5 new members in the next year, and we're really looking forward to bringing greater diversity to the advisory board. And so, and when he said greater diversity, the board has some reasonable racial and gender diversity. So all that's left is, by diversity, he means greater representation of corporate agriculture.
Oh my.
And and what he's saying is, we're not acting on the recommendations because we don't like them. And we're hoping that we're going to get some people on there who will create recommendations that we do like and we do want to act on. So I consider this to be an enormously troubling comment from an enormously powerful person in the USDA. And
you know, why should corporate agriculture be weighing in on organic? The whole point of organic is going back to, and you know, older, more tried and true earth-centric methods, and then evolving them forward with greater specificity and nuance. And since you know, the corporate agriculture methods, you know, are a completely other pathway. It's almost like saying, you know, the automakers should rule on the bicycles or something. You know, it's it just doesn't make any sense. I just also want to point out to listeners, you know, that this is why what you're doing at Real Organic, you know, Dave, what you and the other folks are at Real Organic are doing is so important, because if we value this healthy food, you know, we need a watchdog. Because, you know, all of the meetings and drilling down into the policies, you know, we're in a time where people are scrutinizing policies much more than ever before and with greater specificity. And it's a really good thing, because we, you know, and it's something that I've reported on and fought for and encouraged and all of that. And I'm, you know, this kind of civic engagement in specificity is really important, and your being there on site and tracking all of this is essential to the food movement, because, you know, I think in a way from the consumer side, you know, people were just, oh, if I buy the food, that constitutes my vote and I'm done. But no, we really now have to, you know, as people who eat food, as eaters, we have to defend the food we want. And, you know, the work you're doing is making that possible, so we're not kind of not following the action and asleep at the switch, and then, ba-boom, you know, we have lost important standards and what we believe to be organic food, because it's so labeled by the department you're talking about, you know, is not in certain key ways. So just
right.
Thank
and,
you for
and,
what
and
you're
to
doing.
Say that when we started the Real Organic Project, our vision was not that we would be watchdogs. There are good watchdogs. Our vision was that we would work to create an alternative system so that farmers and eaters could find each other and have in-depth conversations about why food matters, why this way of farming matters. So we were really intending to be focused on the positive. But I have to say that I keep getting drawn into watchdog role, because it's just so critical what's happening, and I don't think we can just abandon government. We need to fight for good government, and so we do. Let me give an example, if I can, of one place. So Real Organic is really based on the fact that the National Organic Program is a good program, except for a very small number of farms that are being certified that shouldn't be. And they're basically confinement animal operations. I will call them CAFOs. That's a C-A-F-O. And that stands for concentrated animal feeding operation, confinement. And that's where they grow the food somewhere else, and the cows or the chickens live in some building, and the food is brought to them. And it is not allowed in organic standards, and yet somehow the USDA refuses to apply those standards and demand that the certifiers apply them to prohibit that. So that's a big deal. And another big deal is the incredible growth of soilless production, of hydroponic production for fruits and vegetables. And again, that is pretty much against the law based on the language of the Organic Food Production Act, and yet it is being permitted. And things have gotten to the point where the National Organic Program doesn't even feel compelled to answer direct questions about what the standards are from people like me, from people on the National Organic Standards Board. We can get into that if you want. But the third thing is that there's a lot of grain that is fraudulently imported that is not certified as organic when it gets on the ship, but it is certified when it comes off the ship. And, you know, this is something happening to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And the one nice thing about this issue is it's a bipartisan issue, and pretty much everybody in Congress agrees that they don't want to see this kind of fraud. And so they have allocated money to the USDA to stop it. I would say so far efforts have been ineffective. So we hope that they will get better at this. But those three issues were the things that really inspired the Real Organic Project. There's lots of details to, well, you know, is this the best way of farming or that? But these are really profound, basic things, that organic food should be grown in healthy soil, and that there's a whole wisdom is the closest word I can come to that system. It's something that co-evolved over hundreds of millions of years, and we are part of it. We co-evolved with it, and that's how we get good nutrition. So the idea that you can mix it up in a blender and water it on the plants and that that provides the proper nutrition, we just don't begin to know enough to get that right. So that's one. And then the livestock one is the one I think is kind of easiest for people. Well, it's pretty easy to understand fraudulent grain import. They're lying. But I think that people can understand that they don't want their animals to be raised in a factory. And in order to combat that, the advisory board spent years coming up with animal welfare standards. And we have to say that the existing standards prohibit that. They say that animals must have real outdoor access. But nonetheless, it was being interpreted by certifiers that you could have confinement operations, and particularly in this case, we're talking about for chickens. And certified organic eggs in America, unfortunately, I would say over 80% of them are coming from large CAFOs, from large confinement things where the chickens never go outside and they live, you know, in a big factory and all the feed is brought in. And it's a very economically intelligent way, if your idea of economics is short-term profit and completely ignoring unintended consequences, health care, animal welfare, you know, any kind of humane treatment of animals. So it pays, and that's why conventional egg production is completely oriented this way, and so now is organic. And this is a horror to organic farmers who do not want them to be certified. So the advisory board came up with animal welfare standards that would have even more clearly prohibited this kind of livestock raising being called organic. And it went through a long process with the National Organic Program. And then finally, the last day of Obama's administration, the outgoing administration approved it and said this is now going to be the new rule for the National Organic Program. And the first day of Trump's administration, they pulled the animal welfare reform for further study. And I think about 4 months later, they rejected it forever. And, you know, the people who were rejecting it were the large egg CAFOs and the Pork Producers Council, who has nothing to do with organic farming whatsoever. And some of their friends in Congress, the pork producers want it rejected because the last thing they want is for the USDA to be talking about animal welfare and humane treatment of animals. Because if you take anybody into one of those CAFOs, you know, likely they'll throw up. It's not a pleasant place to live. And, you know, the fact is that people with a lot of money have a lot of influence in Congress. They just do. And people who run large CAFO operations have a lot of money, so they have a lot of influence. So this is just an example of complete politics having nothing to do with the will of the people winning at the end of the day. And it shows how very hard it is and is going to be for us to trust the USDA to successfully maintain the integrity of the program.
Yeah, that's a huge issue. You know, one thing that occurs to me is, you know, you made a point in you know, what you just said that, you know, some people's response to this level of corruption and cynicism and misuse of power that you're describing is basically to write off government, you know, and say, oh, nothing can work through government, let's not even bother, there's, the, you know, but in fact, it's not the government, it's the industry infiltration of an influence upon the government that is producing this state of affairs. And so, you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy if people don't become the countervailing force and step up in great measure, you know. And it's not that, you know, oh, if we just ignore this and you know, wash our hands of it, government will go away. No, it will become increasingly abusive. It's a problem. It's you know, it's not going away. You know, the inertia of not regulating for humane treatment, regulating for biochemical safety, regulating for, you know, economic protection of, you know, our own producers and all of that over, you know, these exports and everything, all of that, it's not, you know, it's not like declaring hands-off government and I wash my hands of it is going to solve that. It's actually the opposite movement, which we're also seeing, you know, in other domains on the national level, of stepping up and paying attention and being that countervailing force. Because otherwise, it's, you know, and if we just take an incremental approach, oh, well, a little bit will work, you know, we actually are, you know, the problems accelerate. So the more we don't tend to them, the worse they get. I think that's part of the lesson. And, you know, interestingly also, this infiltration, this, you know, kind of undermining of healthful, humane practices in animal welfare is also, I think, something that people, especially young people, have a lot, and, you know, others as well, have a lot of revulsion toward. And so, you know, then it kind of becomes that the only solution is to renounce, for example, you know, any form of consuming livestock, you know, eggs or any of it, in favor of, you know, a diet that is produced by a corporate monocrop agriculture. And so, you know, the whole the quality of our food, the humane treatment of animals, the equitable treatment of labor, all of that, you know, has to be fought for rather than, on the one side, you know, taking a hands-off government approach and the other renouncing any foods that have been degraded, you know, and done in a harmful manner, because this is what is going on, you know. So
yeah.
If you
renounce,
you don't have to do anything.
Been degraded now, you know. They're. I mean, you know, that's one of the interesting pieces of research from a guy named Don Davis, was looking at whatever 50 years of USDA, you know, testing of nutritional content of basic foodstuffs, and it steadily declined over that period. So we're not talking about Doritos here. We're talking about potatoes and tomatoes and eggs, and that they're steadily having less nutritional density and less nutritional diversity. And the, you know, so there really is no place to hide. There's only one food system, and I think that if, you know, if somebody is starving in another country, but, you know, we're okay, I think that we're not okay. You know, we're all connected. And, you know, one of the things that we're learning from this amazing changes in technology and information and is that in fact, you know, we are one planet, and there is no planet B, as they say. So, All of our actions impact other people in parts of this same global system. And there are problems that we face, like climate, that can only be ultimately dealt with on a large scale. And this is a conundrum. This is a koan that we all face, which is, how do we change a large system when we're just a small person? But it's a koan that we need to puzzle over and not walk away from. I, you know, it's so easy when we start to have that conversation, people go into overwhelm and then depression and then, helplessness. And that's not helpful. So we need to find a way to approach this in which we find some mojo, some hope, some way to make choices and make changes. So yes, I agree that, and I didn't always agree, but I do agree now that we do need to include attempts, however difficult they might seem, to reform and take back government. And we can look at countries like Denmark and a lot of things that we're struggling to do, they've already done. So I'm saying it's possible to construct a government that is more responsive, that is more responsible. Denmark's an interesting case because they have made a national commitment on their federal level to take their food system to 30% organic as quickly as possible. And they've committed many, many millions of dollars to do this. So I think it might be $150 million. Maybe it's $50 million, but this is a small country. And so the level of commitment that they're making is huge if you were to put that on an American level. And they're doing it because they think that the organic production, and we're talking about real organic production, doesn't just benefit the people who eat that food. Of course it benefits them, but it benefits the whole society because of how the food is grown and the downstream consequences of that kind of farming. And the climate consequences of that kind of farming are profound. So I mentioned Denmark because it's like, well, I think we can do that. And maybe we can't do it immediately on the federal level, but maybe we can do it on the Vermont level or the New York level or the California level. And then we work our way up to the whole country.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's really true. That's what grassroots means, too, which is, that sense of individual isolation, what can I do? Well, I can, not eat this or not eat that or something. But what can I do with my neighbors, with my region, with my community, so that I'm not doing it alone and I'm not having to individually recycle hope when we have setbacks, and watch destructive or disappointing things happen. If we do it in community with other people, then we actually, it's a synergy, and we reinforce and rebuild that hope and that capacity all the time. And maybe this is the optimal moment to bring up an upcoming conference that you're going to be participating in this coming week, actually beginning, tomorrow. So this is the Soil and Nutrition Conference. This is the 9th annual conference, Catalyzing a Regenerative Future. And this is where a whole group of dedicated farmers and systemic thinkers and organizers and health-oriented folks are getting together November 14th through 17th in Southbridge, Massachusetts, to refine our understanding, talk about different forward-moving initiatives and all of that. And I'm doing several shows with conference speakers. This is the first with you, Dave. People, you can find this online at soilandnutrition.org. And, check out the group of speakers and the topics. And some might wish to attend. The conference is also year after year videotaped. And there will be forthcoming videotapes so that people can also participate in the learning. We learn together, we grow together, we act together, and we renew hope together, So it's really, that's kind of, it's something that the younger generations figured out and are kind of modeling back to the more individualistic older generations. And it's a good thing. We're the whole idea of, I'm going to have to do it all myself or whatever. It just, it's kind of, there's a new way being forged, and it is a hopeful thing to participate in that. So just wanted to mention
yeah.
that as well.
No, I'm looking forward to that conference. I will be there doing a round table. They call it a fireside chat. So anybody wants to talk about this. But I'm looking forward to meeting John Eckert, who's the retired professor, I think, from Missouri, who's a great agricultural economist. And you know, Judy Schwartz will be there. She's one of my heroes. So it will be a really good workshop. Let me also throw out that there's going to be a symposium at Dartmouth next spring, April 3rd and 4th, that I'm working very hard to organize. And we have an unbelievable group of speakers coming, and our Saturday night keynote will be Paul Hawken. But maybe we can talk about that when we get closer to it, and we can do a thing about that, because we really have an amazing group. But, we need to get together. We need to talk. We need to support each other. When we started the Real Organic Project, I talked to so many people, organic pioneers, who were just so depressed by what was going on the national level. And they felt so alone and helpless. And, you know, they don't feel so helpless now. There's a great story of that Bessel van der Kolk tells of a group of kids who were in a school bus that was hijacked. This was years ago, back in the 60s. And they were driven into the woods, and they were locked into the bus, and the crazy guy went off to, I don't know, ransom them or whatever he was going to do. And the kids were all freaked out, but one kid saw there's a skylight, and he managed to force it open. And he got out, and all the kids got out, and they escaped through the woods. And what was interesting, Bessel is a trauma expert, is that years later, all the kids, as grown-ups, had PTSD, except for the kid who broke open the window. And, you know, that's an important lesson, which is that if we remain in a state of freeze and helplessness, you know, the consequences, the negative consequences, are great for us, just emotionally. And if we can find a way towards action and coming together and realizing that we're not alone, you know, I think that we go through all this, win or lose, we go through it in a much healthier way, much better way, and with That's some possibility wonderful. Of winning. In freeze, all we can do is lose.
That's such a wonderful insight. You know, I write about that a lot, too, because, you know, I have a psychology background back, you know, behind all of this. And I've often, you know, and in effect, all that we are, you know, kind of confronted with right now, either directly happening to people, like the, you know, painful situation with the migrant children, which, you know, will impact their lives, and it's impacting all of us who care and who look at it, you know. And certainly signing on to be an advocacy journalist is, you know, a way to look at more traumatic and upsetting situations than one would ordinarily do, you know, if I was just, you know, working in a bookstore or something. You know, for sure. But the fact that there's a purpose and a meaning, and that you do it together with others, is just mobilizing in a way that fearing it and avoiding it and bargaining with it and temporizing with it, which are, you know, in effect, freeze response. You know, it's a form of freeze response where you're resisting facing up to it. I think that can be really equally, if not, as you're pointing out, more debilitating to people, and so then may be understood, you know, so that when in that kind of, I always think of it, too, as, you know, as bargaining, too. You know, denial is a form of bargaining. And some people think activism is a form of bargaining. And, you know, if that's proven to have been so at the end of the day, well, you know, we did all we could. And if we break through because of it, well, we were bargaining in an action terrain that can lead to really positive change in the situation. So, yeah, I actually think the psychological dimension of all of this is super important and needs to be better understood, because as the pace of what we're dealing with accelerates, more and more people are affected. And instead of just only looking at, you know, the disturbing actions of the government or at the dilemmas of the political reality. I think it's also really important to identify for ourselves and for each other where we are. You know, so it's not like I can solve it alone by myself, but where am I in it and with it, and how is the way I am, how I'm with it, and how might there be a more optimal way, you know, so.
Yes, yes. I hope that these are some of the issues that will be discussed at the Dartmouth Symposium next year. One of our keynotes is a man named David Grinspoon, and his book is also the title of the symposium, which is Earth in Human Hands. And, you know, he really faces that conundrum of being one car on an L.A. freeway, and somehow the whole system works because somehow it's a system and everyone is basically going in the right direction on the right road and not hitting each other most of the time. And yet it's entirely made up of individuals who are making individual choices. And how do we take that systemic understanding to the very real dilemma that we're in as a species on the planet? And the fact is that we are now inadvertently and unexpectedly controlling the climate of the planet through our actions, or having profound impact. And how do we make that impact more positive and less negative? So, and I would say that, you know, one of the things Paul Hawken will talk about is that farming must be part of that solution, a big part of that solution, not the only part, but a big part. And, you know, we have to all find the ways we can do what we can. Let me add just a couple things that I always have to say, which is that, you know, I'm saying a lot of bad things about the National Organic Program, and I still always buy organic in the store. If I know a farm, great. If I can grow it myself, great. If I can't, if I can be in a CSA or farmer's market, great. If I can't do any of that, I go to the store. If I can buy from a farm I know of, great. If I can't, I still will rely on the USDA label, knowing that it's deeply flawed, but it's at the moment the best we got. I hope by next year we will have Real Organic Project labels starting to show up in stores. We've got about 200 farms certified now. We'll be up to 400 by April. And they're certified all over the country. This is going to take us a few years. We need your help. We need your support. But we will get there. Most of the certified organic farms in America are real organic. And it's a relatively small number of CAFOs and hydros that are hijacking this pretty well done system by and large, but we've got to fix the problems. So I always want to say that, because I don't want people to go away from one of these talks and going, well, okay, I can't trust organic, I'll just buy conventional. Don't do that. But the other thing you can do is go into the store, you know, go into the Park Slope Co-op, go into the new Wegmans in Brooklyn, go into Fairway and say, are these eggs from a CAFO, these organic eggs? Is this organic milk from a CAFO? Are these organic tomatoes hydroponic? Are these organic berries hydroponic? And if 50 people go into every store in America tomorrow and ask that, we will win overnight. And that's the truth, because there will be a revolution when the stores go, oh my God, people really care about this. I can't believe that 50 people asked me and I don't know the answer, because they won't. But if 50 people ask every store, they will find out. So let's pull away the Band-Aid. Let's tear off the veil of secrecy that is hiding all of this, fully intended to mislead us. You know, they completely understand that if they had, you know, a nice picture of a hydroponic operation of 1,000 pots on the cover of the berry box, people would not choose to buy those berries. And they fully know they had a nice picture of cows in a CAFO instead of that nice cow in the pasture, or chickens in a CAFO instead of chickens in the pasture on the milk carton or the egg carton. People would not buy those. They know that, and that's why they lie. So let's force them to tell the truth, and we will win.
Yes. Because there's obviously nobody watching that the marketing materials correspond to the situation. Because that actually, if I were, queen of the world or whatever, that would not be allowed. You wouldn't be allowed
exactly.
to just say anything in marketing and then just doing something entirely different. It's like, as a communicator, I am offended by that because it's a misuse of the trust that people need
yes.
to have when communications are happening, So, in a degrading of the integrity inherent in communication, that too has been corrupted and in such a broad level that, we don't always acknowledge it or think we can do something about it. It actually reminds me of some video artists that I knew back in the day who did a video called Talking Back to Your TV Set. And, it was like, I love the idea of it because it was like, we're not just there to drink all this in and then believe it, there has to be some critical, faculty, some talk back, some pushback, some dialogue, otherwise it's a one-way communication in which, the people are gulled and, that isn't right. What you say is true. And the idea of also talking to the store. I think even practicing talking to anybody in any small position of local authority, whether it's, as you say, rightly so at the store, or, an elected official or somebody in local government, or, being willing to talk and have the conversation rather than training ourselves just to accept what is given, and be fearful about saying something, So, like, for example,
yeah.
I've heard many integrative, healthcare practitioners who, they're very forthright, this is wrong, and that is wrong, and the other is wrong, but then if you go, if you say, well, did you try to, intervene in government? Are you organizing people to, kind of speak up about this? Of, oh, no, I don't want to. So that's, understandably fear-based. And as we see things get, kind of devolving a bit, it's natural to feel that fear, So it's not like you're wrong to feel it, but, taking the courageous, this goes back to your point about, the freeze response, taking that courageous step feels a little better. And is energizing and more productive and actually should become a little bit more habitual. So if more of us made that habitual, then what's really right for people in the planet would be happening, will happen. So anyway,
yes.
that's my little build on what you said. Yeah,
I agree with you, Allison. I think that's right. And I would add that, everybody's busy, and I think that we all have some fear of picking up a microphone and speaking, whether that's through a letter to a friend or a letter to all your friends or a letter to a bunch of people you never met, or getting up and speaking at an event, that we all have, or appearing on a radio show. We have some anxiety that, we will be found out to be stupid. We will be found out to be uninformed. We'll found out to be a fraud, all these things. But we need to do this because there are no, like, brilliant experts who are going to come save the day. It's just us. And, mm-hmm. When the USDA first took over organic certification back about 20 years ago, and I was opposed to that, but I don't think I did a whole lot of organizing, nor did I spend a whole lot of time going to meetings after that, because I thought, well, what possible impact could I have on the federal government? What possible impact could I have on what the USDA decides? These decisions were way past my pay grade. And I actually think I was wrong. I think that, what I see in the process is that, in fact, a relatively small number of people are making these decisions and they're talking to each other. And when we had a rally at the final meeting to discuss hydroponics in Jacksonville, Florida in 2017, 60 farmers came to that meeting. It's unheard of for 60 farmers to come to a National Organic Standards Board meeting. That's not who comes to those. It's lobbyists who come to those. It's It's people who are paid to be there. This is their living, to advocate for some additive, for synthetic additive to be allowed for organic processing. So to have 60 farmers in the room testifying was kind of a revolution. And I will say that we did not win the vote as a result of those 60 farmers, but we did start a movement. And those 60 yes. farmers went back all around the country, and now they're connected, and they're talking to each other, and they're saying, you know what, I'm not alone. So I think it's important that we do this. And I don't mean that there will be one, you know, rebel alliance. I think that I very much like Paul Hawkins' image of the blessed unrest, and that there are 100,000, 200,000 various groups of people, organizations, and they're not organized, but they're all working towards a common goal in their own little aspect of it, their own little part of it. And that we are, this blessed unrest is like the immune system of the human race reacting to these toxins, which are just the insanity of the decisions that are being made. So it's a nice image. Yeah.
Mm, wonderful.
That, you know, we need to be diverse like any good ecosystem.
Right. That's really true. That really is true. Yeah, the diversity is beauty too. I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, being from a very diverse, you know, an environment where there's a lot of human diversity as opposed to plant diversity, for example, which sadly there is not here in New York City. But you know, I mean, I think whether we're from the, you know, whether we're close to nature and can really appreciate and value nature's biodiversity, or whether we're in places where there are diverse humans and we can carry the message about honoring and respecting the human diversity, you know, it's like the two are actually reflecting the same principles, the same natural principles. And and so that whole thing is also that, you know, to be inclusive and to, you know, kind of open your arms to the world and have a broad embrace, you know, in a sense, which isn't what we've been taught in a very, you know, survival-oriented, individualistic culture that we're in and everything. You know, I think it's inevitably heart-opening. It may seem overwhelming because you're kind of expanding the table of your concerns. But then there are other people to, and other groups, as you point out, to carry different pieces of it, you know, in different aspects of it, and connect the dots. So, you know, that's, I love that whole metaphor. That's so wonderful, you know.
Yes.
So, and the animal kingdom is there, too, you know, of course, participating. And you know, and we're also related, you know, and accountable to them as well for these outcomes and to, you know, to all nature and all beings. So, yeah, I mean, I have to say your symposium sounds fantastic. So I'm going to have to, we'll definitely have to do something at the time. That sounds really wonderful. It must be super fun to be planning that, actually.
It is. It's really exciting. I get to work with great people, and I'm communicating with these just wonderful thinkers and speakers. And, you know, some of the speakers will be farmers, and some of them won't be good speakers. And I love that, too, that we wanted to make sure that we didn't just have people who are terribly comfortable getting up and talking in front of 900 people. We want to get people who'd be terrified at the prospect and would stumble and speak haltingly, because we wanted to have some voices that are never heard, and we're trying to figure out how to do that as well as we can. Last year, we had a symposium at Dartmouth last year, and again, some of the speakers were really used to that and comfortable, and we had some, and we made sure that many of the speakers were farmers, and some of them, you know, were very shy and awkward, and I think that what I heard afterwards is that their voices were very much appreciated by the people in the audience. And, of course, the next time those farmers get up, they'll be a little less shy and awkward. So it's a process. But Yeah, we won't, you know, it's interesting. I met yesterday with a group of academics at Dartmouth, actually wonderful people. I was really impressed by them. And they are serious about wanting to create real change in the human use of the energy system. And they really get it, that what we're up against. And I thought, how wonderful to have people like these who are, you know, PhD and post-PhD and enormously deeply informed about one thing, and have them on a stage with farmers, many of whom, you know, didn't even go to college, but they're enormously informed about something else. And, you know, you put all that together and you've got a pretty compelling movement. And that's what we're in. We're all in this. We all eat. And who grows the food and how is it grown? And it's of critical importance to all of us. So even if you don't eat my tomatoes that I grow, it's of importance to you how they're grown, and vice versa for, you know, how that milk is produced. So, you know, these are issues of import for all of us. And, of course, if you do eat the meat or the milk or the eggs or the tomatoes or the kale, then how it was grown is really important to you, because you are what you eat, and what are you eating? So, and by and large, you know, there are some very talented, skilled people who are working pretty hard to make sure you don't understand what you're eating. And, you know, they're making a lot of money off what you eat. They're doing it by selling it to you very inexpensively. And that's where there's this really complex conundrum that we face, which is that we have the cheapest food in the history of the world, and in terms of the percentage of our per capita income. And it's cheaper than Europe's by about, I think, 15%. And it's cheaper than it was in America 20 years ago by 15%. And yet, it does not seem to, cheap food does not seem to end hunger. Cheap food does not create equitable food system. And it doesn't create, I think it might be time to end. All right,
yeah,
Alice.
It is. Well, we've been talking with Dave Chapman of the Real Organic Project. You know, come to the Soil and Nutrition Conference this weekend at soilandnutrition.org. Thank you so much, Dave, for being with us, and thank you, listeners. We'll be back with the next edition of Connect the Dots next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern. Be well. Keep marching forward. I'm Allison Rose Levy. There was the sky.